Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other enjoyable and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
I've always wanted to do that. Music by Richard Strauss, often linked to space travel. It was used in 2001, A Space Odyssey, the movie, and to introduce many a BBC coverage of the Apollo moonshots. Hello, I'm Robin Williams with In Conversation, this time with rocket scientist Ken McCracken. Ken grew up in Tasmania, where he learned both his science and to be self-reliant. So self-reliant that the Americans snapped him up to help them as the space race took off. Well, now Dr. McCracken has written all about it in a scintillating memoir called Blast Off. And to start, Ken, do remind us of that choice thought that John Glenn had before he blasted off into space himself and wondered about the tendering system for those rocket parts.
Yes, Robin. Well, it is said that John Glenn was sitting up there for hours waiting for the thing to go bang. And he was asked, what was it you were thinking of while you were lying there all that time? He said, well, I was sitting on top of 2 million parts, each of which was built by the lowest bidder. And that rather summarised the space program. I had a little bit of a run-in with a very large electronic company that everyone knows the name of, that we were buying a special form of photomultiplier, which we needed to avoid the satellite being, or the instrument on the satellite that went to Venus, being destroyed by the radiation as it went through the Earth's radiation belt. And so we specified a very fancy photomultiplier with special metals in it. It was to be delivered in 90 days. We had to have the satellite finished in a year. 90 days came and went, no photomultiplier. 120 days, no photomultiplier. I'm going bananas. And ultimately they came. My colleague tested them. He ran and he said, Ken, they're four times better than they thought they were. I said, four times nothing. They've given us the wrong photomultipliers. So I phoned this very large company and danced around for about half an hour getting them to admit that this is what they've done. So I sent a telex to the president. I didn't muck around, to the very top of this very large company, and explaining that they had really done the dirty on us, and that since NASA was very interested in knowing the provenance of various things, that they would be very interested to know what the company had done.
And by the way, did it matter that they'd sent you the standard photomultipliers? Couldn't you just have stuck those in and got away with it?
Well, the way we knew it then, we thought that the photomultipliers, the standard ones, would be ruined as they passed through the Earth's radiation belt.
So it really mattered. Okay.
It really mattered, yeah. And they knew this when they took the order. Anyway, about an hour later, there was a great commotion. The chap head of the institution I was working at, screaming about people sending irresponsible telegrams to the president of Company X, and that the president wanted to talk to me. And the head of our institution thought something very bad should happen to me. Anyway, went down to talk to this president of Company X, and his first comment was, well, we're sorry what we did to you. It was totally inexcusable. And would it be sufficient if we got the photomultipliers to you in 5 days?
This is not having delivered in over 120 days. Yes. They said they could do the impossible in 5 days.
Exactly. And that's exactly, Robin, what I said to him. I said, you're joking. And he said, look, I know it seems strange, but will you trust me that we will deliver them in 5 days and they will be the right ones? And they were delivered and they were the right ones. And all I can say is that either somebody else with a bigger pocketbook was going to get them, or they had been told by somebody not to deliver them. But we never will know.
Isn't that extraordinary? Now, the point of this story, apart from the fact that you need to have really good equipment before you can run a spaceship, for God's sake. You know, it's very important than going all that distance. Is here was an extremely young Australian scientist in America, which is far more deferential. And it taught you, actually, to speak your mind, having got the facts right.
Absolutely. And I should say, Robin, this was not the first time this happened, because NASA, first of all, had told us we couldn't use these photomultipliers and other things because they'd never been flown in space before. And I had a real barney with NASA headquarters on that occasion and sorted it out ultimately. It taught me, as you say, a young scientist on a two-year postdoc visa, which was already 2 years overdue, to go for it. And that with our Australian background, our Australian education was enormously good in those early days because it had taught us to think on our feet and it had taught us to go for it.
And of course, your education meant that you were extremely self-reliant because you'd handle this equipment yourself on your own in Hobart or maybe in another lab in Australia. And so being so self-reliant, you were far more confident and able to get on with things than these wonderfully trained American scientists from MIT and so on.
That's exactly so. I mean, I would go to lunch with these PhD students and they would make me feel a complete idiot. They knew all the equations of this, that and the other thing. They knew such and such a theory. I knew none of it. But then they started to talk about working in the laboratory. And I listened and I thought, what tree have these guys come down from? Because they had no laboratory skills at all. I'd been up in New Guinea, a one-man band, fighting the fungus, fighting the humidity, and had learnt, as you say, to figure it out, no one to ask, you do it.
So the Australian education was damn good in those days?
It was damn good, and I have to say, from what I can sample of it now, through my children and grandchildren, it's still very good. We have to fight to keep it that way. But there is no doubt in my mind that I and my peers got enormous training of both the theoretical stuff, because we had what we needed, but the practical stuff. And more than anything, the thing that I think matters in all of these is the Australian attitude of give it a go.
Yes.
And in all my time, it is because I was prepared to give it a go and others wouldn't. That have done well for me.
Just in case people think that you are being something of a picky person, we must remind all those who have heard about the complexity of space missions that if one component is wrong, if one line of instruction is wrong, as with the Hubble telescope, the whole enterprise can go cactus. Just remind us about what went wrong with the famous Hubble telescope, which we've seen performing wonderfully so far, but in the beginning was a disaster.
Yes, Robin, well, that was an example where NASA decided to save the odd 100 million or so. They knew that there had been mirrors designed for Earth observation, for spying purposes, and they decided to use those mirrors, that is, the subcontractor decided to use those mirrors, or argued that they should, and they said, we will do test procedures and it will cost you $100 million to do this. And NASA decided that this was not necessary. They had forgotten some of the issues that were relevant to use in Hubble. And so that this perfectly good reflector for use for looking at the Earth was flown without appropriate corrections. And that was the big, big lemon. Not the first lemon, but the one we all learned about.
And it didn't work, did it? They had to actually correct it.
They had to.
It was as if you had some sort of myopia and you couldn't see and you needed glasses put on.
That's precisely so. So they sent the astronauts up on the shuttle to clip the new bifocal lens onto the Hubble and make it work.
It's amazing. Before we get back to Hobart and how you started this story, one more anecdote, a poignant one from America. When you're in Dallas and you're expecting the President of the United States for lunch, what happened?
Yes. Sorry, I hesitated. This is a very raw memory, even 40-odd years or whatever it is after. President Kennedy was in re-election mode. He was visiting Dallas, which was a solidly Republican city, but he was doing the rounds, and so he was told he could only talk on education and space. all the usual suspects were rounded up, and my wife and I were space and education, so we were there waiting for him to arrive at the lunch. And we were sitting with the Lord Mayor of Dallas, whose company had built some of the semiconductors that we used in our Pioneer spacecraft. And so we're chatting away, and I hear sirens going by, and then somebody comes over, leans over to the Lord Mayor, and whispers something. And he went ashen. The man whispered something to another man who we thought had had a heart attack. And then the convener went up and he said, first of all, he had earlier said, start eating because the president's been somewhat delayed. But then he came up and he looked ashen. He said, there has been a serious accident. I would suggest that we all leave. And as we were leaving, my wife went into the cloakroom and learnt about the shooting. And as we were driving home, we learned that the president was dead. Up till then, the United States had been a marvellous place.
Easygoing, friendly, relaxed.
Everything. Yeah, there were some things that were wrong, like the segregated bathrooms still in Dallas. But there were many aspects that we from Tasmania, having grown up in the austerity of World War II and the post-war years, it was like Camelot, as the saying was. And suddenly, in that instant, Camelot was dead. And it was a shattering experience, really, to experience something like that. Not absolutely close up, but so close up it didn't matter.
I want to understand how a young man, and you were very young when you went to the States, as we said, from Tasmania, managed to get into such a crucial place in the space race right when it was taking off. How did your schooling that you're so proud of in Tassie equip you to get where you did?
Well, probably the simple way of answering your question is saying most people were not dumb enough to go into it. Space was a very risky business. Risky to your sanity, risky to your reputation. But going back to Tasmania, I just happened to start doing something called cosmic ray research, which was the only thing that was really going in Tasmania. Unbeknown to me, because back then in 1954, we didn't know that there was going to be a space age. We didn't know that there would be satellites. And we didn't know that all the people who were going into cosmic ray science would suddenly become space scientists en masse around about 1959. So here I was, a young bloke who liked electronics and who liked bushwalking, and I was allowed to build a laboratory up in Mount Wellington, which would mean going up in the snow to it. And then I took a laboratory up to New Guinea during the International Geophysical Year. My equipment went to Antarctica. I was learning to do science in a pretty rugged environment with no assistance. In fact, I had no assistance, nor did I have supervisors for much of the time. It was great. I had fun. And then I was invited by one of the very top scientists in cosmic rays, somebody called Bruno Rossi, to work at MIT. And he later told me that he invited me because, A, other people would pay for me, of course, but, B, anyone who could make equipment work in New Guinea must be a good scientist. And he said this with passion, because as a young scientist himself, he had taken an experiment to Eritrea in 1929 and was the first person to prove that the cosmic radiation were particles, protons, and not gamma rays. So Bruno was a really top guy, and he said, come work with me.
Even though you didn't have a PhD quite yet?
Not quite yet. I think it would have been an interesting experiment to have seen what would have happened if I didn't get it. But I did apply without the PhD, and I got it. And I should say, of course, I expected to get offered some posting in the Midwest somewhere in a Boonsville-type university, and I got this letter from MIT, and it just about freaked me out because it occurred to me I was going to make the biggest idiot of myself known to man. But, of course, Tasmania is where Tattersalls coined the phrase, you got to be in it to win it. And so I said, right, let's go. And it, as we've said already, I didn't know a lot of the theory. And it didn't matter one little bit. And, in fact, when I got to MIT, Bruno asked what I would like to do. That was the way it was back then. And I had a few choices, and I said, well, I don't want to do any of them. I want to do something different, because down the basement there was a very large computer for those days called an IBM 704. It's absolutely brain dead by modern terms, but that allowed me to essentially carve my own niche. By 1960, I was very well known just because I did that, with the stimulus of someone like Bruno Rossi, who said, just you do it.
Yes, you're in the beginning of the computer revolution.
Correct.
The beginning of when space was taking off.
Right.
And you had all those contacts in America before it became too kind of weighed down with bureaucracy and all the rest of it. You had free-willing stuff. Now, I want to know about when you went back to Australia, and who are the eunuchs?
Yes, this is an interesting story, as you say. When I was in Hobart learning to be a scientist, I have to say that I tended to do a few things irregularly.
Getting that impression.
And I was a radio amateur, which allowed me to build transmitters and talk to people all around the world. But I suppose I was doing it in a slightly irregular way, so that the government department, whose job it is to ensure the virginity of the ionosphere and that no one does bad things to the ionosphere, kept needing to talk to me. And particularly on one occasion when talking to a cosmic ray physicist on Macquarie Island, or I wasn't, it was his wife who was talking to me, using the equipment of the Australian Corps of Signals, and we managed to interfere with the ABC all round Hobart, and interfering with Auntie was not considered very good in those days. Anyway, I had a good record with these eunuchs of the ionosphere, as I call them. And then, much later, I ended up being in CSIRO, and we were needing to negotiate to put a satellite receiver to receive Landsat images as the satellite whizzed back down over Hobart. And I had to go down and talk to the ionospheric people. Lo and behold, it's some of the same people I had dealings with 25 years ago. And they looked a bit crestfallen by something, but we pressed on and did the business and did everything we wanted to do. And as we were leaving, the technical chap who I knew came up and he said, Ken, you know, we were so disappointed because we thought we'd start the meeting with your file from the 1950s and 60s, but we couldn't find it. And we think maybe it's been asked for by head office in Melbourne. But it was a marvellous, just a little snippet of the way your past can come back to haunt you.
Indeed, and they wanted to chastise you, but couldn't quite do so. And
they
so,
thought they were going to have fun.
Now, the point of that story, really, is someone I've known, Ken McCracken, for all these years, who's been, as we've established, a person who thinks for himself, quite independent, and the last one to get on with the bureaucracy by pulling your forelock and genuflecting. How, when you came back to Australia, did you get on with the big knobs, you know, in charge of CSIRO, in charge of science and the government and the Department of Science and so on? Did you have any brawls?
I'm not totally in your face, Robin. I know when to be, shall we call it, appropriately interacting. But the point is that CSIRO back then was a different organisation than it is now. And the people that were there, and particularly Victor Bergman, could see the value of people who were pushing, who went regularly at things. And that was why I was appointed to set up an entirely new division. Victor's comment was, what we want is somebody who has none of the baggage of the past in geophysics, but who has been in the space program and knows the new things, and who knows how to manage difficult programs. And CSIRO was brilliant. In those days, I was given enormous freedom. It was still in the days that CSIRO was still thinking like it had in the 1930s and 40s, when the telephone system was almost non-existent, where the chief, as we called it, of a division, had almost total power. He simply got the money, did it, and told people in Canberra, in Melbourne then, what he'd done, and there was no control, and the chief had to be sensible. He had to know what he was doing, and he had to deliver the goods. Those were good days, without all the control and all the other stuff that happens now, supposedly for economic rectitude, but there were other reasons in there as well. But that was not the CSIRO I inherited. My CSIRO was a very much a gung-ho, let's do something and find a new way of doing it organisation.
Of course, I remember when Paul Wild became head of the CSIRO, a brilliant solar scientist, not terribly far from your own skills. So you had people at the highest level in science running the organisation.
The first paper I ever wrote was with Paul Wild.
Yes.
That's another story.
He died quite recently, yeah. And it's very sad. I had hoped that there would be recognition of his legacy, because not only was a solar scientist, but he helped invent a landing system that made heaps for CSIRO around the world. And he was also very fond of fast trains, which clearly we need in Australia. So on those three lines, he was a great man.
Yes. Oh, Paul was the type of man the CSIRO executive was then. Far-seeing, people who took risks and who expected scientists to be good scientists.
And did they deliver the goods per buck?
Did they? Yes, they did. And look at our wine that we have today, which came from a wine research. Look at my own CSIRO division. We provided the initial work in all remote sensing, in exploration under the surface. The CSIRO divisions of those days delivered what we were meant to deliver, which was competitive advantage but not products. We could have another interview about this.
Yeah, well, you also delivered the banknotes, didn't you?
Well, the banknotes was this funny episode where I, as a space scientist, was asked to be on a committee to look at replacing the old paper banknotes with something new which would not be counterfeited so easily. And there were other attributes that they desired to have in the new banknotes. And so there was basically a committee of about 10 that barnstormed for about a year under the guidance of Nugget Coombs to come up with concepts which would be much more proof against counterfeiting. And the net result of that was the modern plastic banknote, which now we see made round the world.
Yeah, we can blame you for that.
Yes,
money in
can.
Our pockets.
Excellent. Well, no, there are some other people at CSIRO
yes,
who get more of the blame.
Sure. What about the future? Now, the future of Ken McCracken as a farmer is...
I'm buying cattle.
The Southern Highlands. You said you've got some remaining involvement in Maryland and a couple of other places still in space research. What are you doing and how will you keep your fingers wet, if you like, or dry up in space for the next few years?
My approach has always been never to go back to what I used to do. So around about 2000, I looked at what we were getting from glaciological evidence and realised there was a lot more there than A, people were giving it credit, and B, that we could learn a great deal about the interplanetary magnetic fields, about the sun. And this was a virgin area because all the cosmic ray people thought it was rubbish. All the people doing glaciology thought that anything to do with the sun was rubbish. And sitting in the middle, there was something that very few people, I'm being slightly over the top, there were two people in the world who I joined forces with. And that continues. One of them, a Swiss gentleman, Jörg Baer, he and I are writing a book at present on the glaciological study of a isotope of beryllium, beryllium 10. Beryllium 10 is a weird one. It doesn't exist normally here on Earth. It's only produced when cosmic rays smash into atoms in the upper atmosphere. And that is giving us a record of the manner in which the sun, the cosmic rays, and the interplanetary magnetic fields have been varying for thousands and thousands of years. That's my Bronze Age space science I'm doing. I work at another institution called the Institute of Space Science in Bern, Switzerland, on similar type of things. And in my spare time, I look after my farm and I get involved in things like climate change, which you never know when something with my background, when something will come along which looks interesting and where you feel you can contribute. Maybe it will be a contribution which not everyone will appreciate, but sometimes that's necessary.
Ken McCracken, never a mincer of words. His book, Blast Off, is a gem. Next week, I shall be in conversation with someone who did it the other way round. He grew up in the United States and then came to live and work here in Australia. Professor Phil Long from the University of Queensland. I'm Robin Williams.
My name is Bruce.
I've got about
18 sets of seven dwarfs.
It's another crisp, clear night here on my street.
Every street has a story.
He's somewhat of a chatter to people in the neighbourhood. And
venture outside, and it sounds like there's a war going on.
It's not too late to tell us a story of your street. And you can be inspired by downloading or streaming Street Stories My Street Sampler from the Radio National website.